Okay, maybe some questions and some little bit discussion here. Yeah.
Is part of the training to speak precisely the thing that you fear? I remember a story in Gautama Rinpoche where a dog was coming towards him, and he turned around, faced the dog. I remember reading this great story about Dhamma Shogun, where he was a monastery, and there was this terrible person who aggravated everybody, and they asked the director of the monastery to get rid of this person. He said, no, I pay that person to be here. I love that story.
Right? Yeah.
People went around saying, are you being paid? When people were acting nasty. Are you being paid? Right? So, like with your prison work, I mean, are you facing your fears? Is that a good antidote?
That's interesting. I've never thought of my prison work that way.
Fears about killers?
Yeah. I think it is. Because, I mean, I never had the intention to do prison work. I didn't go seek it. These people just started writing to me. I have vows, so I don't have a choice. You know, people need help, I help. I don't have a choice in that matter. So, which is the nice thing about having vows. You can't let your mind go, oh, I don't like these people. You know, it's like you don't have a choice. You help. But thinking about it now, I think in many ways, for me personally, it is having that function, because some of the guys that I work with have done the things that I fear the most. Yeah? And for me to be able to go and meet them and see them and see something worthwhile in them and trust them, because I do trust them. I mean, I tell them things about myself and so on. Yeah, I think in some ways it is doing that. I think it can be very good. We have to do it when we're ready to do it, okay? It doesn't mean that we do it only when we feel comfortable. Because if we're really going to practice, we have to be able to do things we don't feel totally comfortable with. But we also have to be ready to do it. We can't push ourselves to do something that we're not quite ready yet to do. I saw, talking about facing your fears, I remember once I was on an international flight. This is the only time I watch movies, is when you can't avoid it, on these long international flights. And there was a movie, you know, one of these, I think it was a clip from some, like, 30s movie or something, you know, with this beautiful woman going in a dark room and there being a skeleton there. And she turns around and sees the skeleton and screams, you know. And I remember watching that in the movie and thinking, now you should talk to the skeleton. Yeah. Because the skeleton is just a skeleton, isn't it? It's just a skeleton, you know, to talk to it. Instead of assuming the skeleton is there and it's going to destroy you, turn around and talk to it and be its friend. Yeah? So I think that this, we do this maybe with external people who we fear or distrust. You know, turn around and talk to them. And I think also with the parts of ourself, the skeletons, the psychological skeletons that we have, you know, that we carry around in our closet full of baggage, yeah, to turn around and talk to those skeletons. And some of them might just evaporate when we do. Yeah. So instead of running away from everything that seems terrible, you know, to build a little bit of a courageous mind that can turn and, you know, try and deal with the situation. And I don't know about you, but sometimes the reason I said to do things, you know, kind of when we're ready to, but sometimes when we don't feel totally comfortable, is I had a situation not too long ago where some stuff came up for me that was like, you know, old stuff from a long time ago, and it was like, I can't handle this, and, you know, I got to get out of this situation, I can't handle it. And I think the real value for me of doing retreat is later on when I did retreat and I reflected on the situation, I realized it was so stupid why I got so bent out of shape because of it, you know? And this is the real value, I think, of doing practice and daily meditation and retreat, is to be able to look back in the situations where we just said, ah, I can't handle this, I got to get out, and really see how our mind was exaggerating and see how our mind was making a big deal out of something that it really didn't need to make a big deal out of. Okay? Because the thing is, as long as our mind holds on to the big deals we make out of things, then we're always going to be trapped and imprisoned by those things. And we're never going to be able to put things down. And I think, you know, for our own happiness, our own psychological well-being, and for the benefit of our spiritual practice and the benefit of the people around us, we have to be able to heal from things that have happened in the past. And the way to heal, or at least the way I found to heal, is to be able to see how my mind has often made a big thing out of things that didn't need to be made a big thing out of. Yeah? And when we think, you know, from a Buddhist perspective about ignorance being the root of cyclic existence, ignorance is making a big deal out of something that doesn't need to be made a big deal out of. Okay? Because ignorance is making everything inherently existent, and it's not inherently existent. So ignorance, you know, is making a big deal, you know, and setting us up for misery. So we see the same thing with anger. You know, because anger is based on this ignorance, that as soon as we grasp things as inherently existent, then anger's, you know, we've already made a big deal about them. Then anger takes the next step and says, you know, oh, this is really terrible, you know. And then, of course, you know, attachment jumps in and says, this is really good. And then there we go again. Okay? But for me, in my meditation practice, this is what I find enables me to put things down from the past, is to see how my mind exaggerated and made a big deal out of things that weren't worth making a big deal out of. Now, you might say, well, you know, what about somebody who was abused as a child or somebody who has post-traumatic stress syndrome, you know? I mean, think of all these young men in Iraq now who are going to come home with PTSD. Yeah? Or how many of the Iraqi citizens are going to suffer from it? Now, somebody's going to say to me, are you saying that their mind is just making a big deal out of something that doesn't need to be made a big deal out of? And when you've lived through a war, that's a horrible thing, then that is a big deal. Okay? On one level, it is a big deal. And it's painful and it's horrible and, you know, it affects people. When you get into Buddhist practice, and especially when you really start looking at the Four Noble Truths in depth, okay, at suffering, the origins, the cessation, and the path. And in specific, when we really get in to looking at the Second Noble Truth, the origins of suffering, you know, and when we really see how ignorance makes a big deal out of things, then we can see that from another viewpoint, when you have this spiritual viewpoint that's based on the reality of the situation being empty of inherent existence, then you can see that every time our mind gets locked in a tragic event, you know, or every time we have results of abuse or PTSD or whatever, that from the Buddhist viewpoint, our ignorant mind is making a big deal out of something that doesn't need to be made a big deal out of. And this is precisely why the understanding of emptiness ceases suffering. Because we're able to say, you know, that's not something that I need to be making a big deal out of. Okay? Now you're going to say,
but how's this possible? You know, if you've been tortured or you've watched somebody else be tortured, how can you say that's not something to be made a big deal out of? Okay? And then you're going to say, and you're a Buddhist and you're talking about compassion, so you should make a big deal out of it. Okay? And this actually gets into this very interesting thing, which you find in the Tibetan text, and it comes up in a different way. But how do you put emptiness together with having compassion? Okay? Because if everything's empty of inherent existence, then does that just mean that suffering doesn't exist? And that sentient beings don't exist? And so in that case, you know, who's there to have compassion for? And there's no suffering, you know. So why do you have compassion? And it appears to be a contradiction between the wisdom realizing emptiness and the compassion caring about sentient beings, you know. And that's the way it appears to our ordinary mind. Have any of you ever had this question in your practice? You had it come up, you know. So the thing about it is, because everything is empty, that's why we have compassion. Okay? If everything were inherently existent, if everything were solid and real and that way from its own side independent, nothing could be changed. It would be useless to have compassion. And things would be inherently evil or inherently corrupt. There would be inherent suffering and no way to change it, because suffering would be independent of causes and conditions. It would be independent of our mind. There would be no way to change it. So forget compassion. But it's precisely because suffering is dependently arising, that it arises due to causes and conditions, that suffering depends on parts, that suffering depends on the mind that conceives and labels it. It's precisely because things are dependent that therefore they're empty, that therefore they can change, and therefore it's worthwhile to have compassion. Okay? Are you following me? Yes? No? Maybe a little bit? Okay? But it's precisely because suffering can be eliminated. If you say, I was abused as a child, or I was in a war and suffered this much or saw other people suffer, and that is imprinted on my mind indelibly, it can never be changed. That's the view adhering to inherent existence, isn't it? Because it's saying, this feeling I have doesn't depend on causes and conditions. It's permanent. It can't change. It exists independently of everything else. That's not true, is it? Because everything we feel exists dependently. So because it exists dependently, if you change the causes, you're going to change what that feeling is. Okay? So if you can go back in a situation in your life that was horribly painful and generate compassion for the people in that situation and see them as suffering sentient beings who were trying to be happy and didn't know the method to be happy, then you can see that situation in a totally different way, instead of just looking at the situation as me and my suffering and what they did to me and how horrible this was for me. See the situation in a totally different way, you know, and have compassion for the others. And then, you know, you can also see that the feelings that you're having are empty, that they arise because of causes. You change the causes by having compassion, and that those feelings go away. Okay? Because as soon as we hold on to some feeling we're having, saying, you know, this happened to be in my life, therefore I have no choice about how I'm going to feel the rest of my life, you know, then we're saying cause and effect don't exist. Aren't we? You know, when we feel helpless in the confront of anything, we're saying cause and effect don't exist, that things can't be changed. And that's wrong, you know, because everything that exists, that's functioning, arose due to causes and conditions. Okay? For it to be sustained depends on causes and conditions. If you change those causes and conditions, it's going to collapse. You know? And that's precisely the reason why we can be liberated and why we can recover from abuse and PTSD and everything else. That was a long answer to your question. Other questions or comments?
Mm-hmm. Could you speak briefly just about life and versus attachment? Because my own mind doesn't have to get attached to things that I love, and yes, these are
opposite. Okay. And difference between love and attachment. By the way, in Open Heart, Clear Mind, there's a chapter about that. But and this is an important thing because we do get it very, very mixed up. Yeah. The thing is, attachment has conditions. Yeah. Attachment, we want somebody else to be happy because of what they do for us. Okay? Love doesn't have those conditions. Love just wants others to be happy because they exist. Attachment wants them to be happy because they make us feel good. Or because we need them, we depend upon them, or something else. Love is able to say, whether I like you or whether I don't like you, I still want you to have happiness and its causes. Okay? So love is much more stable. Yeah, real love is much more stable because even if somebody harms us, we can still wish them to be happy. You know, even if somebody flatters us, we still wish them to be happy. No matter what the other person's behavior is, we still wish well for them. Whereas attachment very easily flips into being upset. Yeah? I'm attached to you because you're part of me, I, my, and mine, and you're not giving me enough attention, and you're not telling me that you love me enough, and you forgot my birthday, and you criticize me, and I'm feeling depressed, and you're supposed to pull me out of it, and you're not doing it, and et cetera, et cetera. And so our attachment very easily falls into getting upset with them. And so you can see how the attachment is based on me, isn't it? Yeah. Your job is to make me happy. Your job is to be everything I want you to be. Impossible. Other questions, comments? Okay. 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 Well, I didn't do a lot on compassion either. Well, I did. Yeah, I did. Yeah, I talked about compassion. Okay, so the joy part. Actually, joy is an antidote to jealousy. Yeah. Because jealousy is a very painful emotion, isn't it? Yeah. Isn't jealousy horrible when you have it? It's always the other person's fault that we're jealous, isn't it? Always. You know, we're just innocent victims and they did this horrible thing, so we're jealous. But joy is the antidote to jealousy because joy just wishes somebody well. Joy rejoices in their happiness. Okay? So, jealousy is saying the happiness shouldn't be yours, it should be mine. You know, excuse me. But sorry, you know, that person is mine and they're making me happy, or that promotion is mine and it's mine to get, or that money should be mine. Okay, so jealousy thinks the happiness should belong to us, and jealousy also can't bear the good fortune of other people. Okay, so when we're jealous, we really put ourselves in a conundrum, aren't we? You know, it's impossible to be happy. So joy is the antidote to that, because joy is the mind that just says, I'm glad when other people are happy. Okay? And this is a very nice mind to train ourselves in, because then we can look around, and whenever we see others being happy, rejoice in it, instead of feeling like we have to compete with them to and get the happiness away from them.
but just to rejoice in it. So when others have temporal happiness, the happiness in samsara, we rejoice. Yeah, people get the promotion, they live in a nicer house, they have, you know, they have whatever it is your dream was, they have it, we rejoice. Okay? And we rejoice in their virtue when other people do good dharma practice instead of trying to put them down. We rejoice in their dharma practice. We encourage their dharma practice. You know, we rejoice in people's spiritual attainments when they get, you know, actualize the bodhisattva levels and everything. We rejoice in that instead of saying, oh, gee, why can't I be a bodhisattva? It's not fair that they got to be a bodhisattva before me. I mean, I've been practicing all of 5 years and it should have happened already. But, you know, just to rejoice. Yeah. Here's the big one. When another Dharma student gets more attention from our teacher than we get. Ah! Then to learn to rejoice. Oh, I'm so glad that person, you know, got that attention from our teacher. Yeah. Have you ever noticed that Uma Dalai Lama's teaching, for example, everybody sits there. How many of you have been to His Holiness's teachings, either here or abroad? You know, everybody's sitting there watching His Holiness as he enters, hoping that His Holiness will look at them. You know? And then you hear everybody afterwards go, the Dalai Lama looked at me. He looked at me. He made eye contact with me. You know? And the real trick to practicing joy is when His Holiness looks at somebody else and you rejoice. You know, or when your teacher has time to speak to somebody, to another student. You know, and you doesn't have time to speak to you, but they have time to speak, you know, because teachers sometimes have limited time. And you rejoice. Isn't it nice that my teacher got to speak, that the other student got to speak to my teacher?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you see everything I'm still hung up on church.
Mm-hmm. You're having a hard time with Bush?
Oh, I mean, I can't. I mean, it is hard, but I can't, you know, watch him on TV.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't listen to this. Yeah. I mean, it's almost physical.
Mm. One thing that I've found to be helpful in that way is, think about if you grew up in his family. Okay? If you grew up with the kind of conditioning that he had as a child, then we might also think like him. Yeah? Because people are just a product of their conditioning.
That is helpful, yeah. Even if these students just proving themselves. No, I mean, that's what he said. Well, you know.
Yeah. But if you see that people are just products of conditioning, yeah, that gives us a little bit of compassion. I mean, because we may have grown up in a different kind of family and a different kind of background where we had, you know, we were inculcated with different values as a child. But if you grew up in a rich Texas oil family with political connections, what kind of things are you exposed to as a kid? Yeah?
Yeah.
And I know, like after 9/11, when so many people were upset about Bin Laden, you know, I think one thing that helped me there is to remember that Bin Laden didn't come out of his mother's womb as a terrorist. You know? I mean, he came out as a little baby. And when we see little babies, I mean, have you ever noticed when you're around public places and you see little babies? They're cute, aren't they? You know? And when he was a baby, if you had met Bin Laden when he was a baby, you would have gone coochie-coo, like you do with all the babies, you know? Yeah. And he was a baby, and he was a toddler, and he learned to walk, and he peed in his diapers, or, you know? I mean, he did things that babies do. So it's not like somebody is inherently a terrorist. Okay, how about if we sit and do a little meditation?